This is the Politics Lab, a podcast that puts politics under a microscope. On this week's episode, Bill and Phil grapple with how the world would be different if China were in charge, and whether that would be a good or a bad thing. And, given the possibility of a Trump victory in November, should Sonia Sotomayor retire now? Now let's go to the lab.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Politics Lab. My name is Bill Muck, and I'm a professor of political science at North Central College. And I'm joined by my colleague and best friend, Dr. Philip Barker, who's a professor of political science at Keene State College. Hey, Phil.
Hey, Bill. How are you? I think you called me Philip Barker. I don't think you've ever called me Philip.
It just felt like it. I wasn't reading off the script. I just went with Philip. I don't know. You were imbuing a professionalism today. I made the jump.
You're finally giving me the respect I'm due.
It's either that or my brain is so mushy after like getting to the final week in the semester that and we're taping in the afternoon, which we now know is not as good as when we tape in the morning. So there's probably a lot of things going on.
It is amazing. The last couple of weeks we've recorded first thing in the morning and it feels I don't think of myself as a morning person, but yeah, it feels like we've still got all our brain power going then. And it feels different now that it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
We may not be morning people, but we're certainly not afternoon people. So
we're not evening people. We're not morning people. Yes. We're just nothing.
We talked about forming a band this week, Phil and I, which is, you know, because we've got a lot of musical talent. But one of the issues was staying up late at night. And I think we both agreed that that's not an option for us.
All of our concerts would be matinees. That's just how it would have to go. We'd play lots of brunches.
That's right. You on the banjo, me playing the accordion. It would be fun. we're going to dive into a couple topics today. Some interesting readings as well. Do you want to remind Phil, everybody how they can stay connected with us?
Yeah. So thepoliticslab.com is the webpage, and you can go there. Click on any of the episodes, but click on this week's episode. We always have readings relevant related to the topics we talk about. So we've got a couple articles about China and the rise of China and what that looks like. And then a really interesting piece in The Atlantic about Sonia Sotomayor and whether she should retire. So all of that can be found at thepoliticslab.com.
That's good. Good stuff. Good webpage. All right. So, Phil, we're going to start today with the question of how would the world be different if China were in charge and whether that would be a good or a bad thing for the world. So we're kind of thinking about China. What do you think? Would it be different? What would it be like if China was running the world?
I think this is a really fascinating question because we've talked a lot over the years about the rise of China. It's really remarkable. I mean, we've been doing this podcast for, I don't know, what, 3 or 4 years at this point? We did the old one before that for 3 or 4 years prior to that. And in that kind of 8-year span, this in the last 10 years, like it feels like we've gone from, hey, China's, you know, becoming a player to suddenly this, like it is the rise of China has happened quickly. And so we've talked a lot about the rise of China and sort of what that means. I feel like we've talked about it some from almost kind of a realist perspective. So, you know, realism in international relations is very much focused on, you know, the kind of power politics and deterrence and whatnot. But there were a couple of articles that we've put up on the webpage that talk about it a lot more, really kind of from this sort of liberal constructivist lens, which is like, what does it look like if China becomes, if not the dominant power, one of the dominant powers in international politics? Because we live in a world and have lived in a world really since World War II that is this kind of Western, kind of American-made world. And so all the stuff we think about when we think about international relations, when we think about global politics, the UN, the World Bank and the IMF, the European Union, human rights, like modern human rights and international law, all of that kind of has its roots in this, you know, rise of America. And so as we look at China rising, one of the things that China repeatedly kind of points out or kind of bristles at is this American-led worldview. And so, I think about this is just in terms of setting it up. Like, there's this whole idea of like hegemonic stability. And people talk about for people who have no idea what I just said, the idea of this theory is like, oftentimes there's one dominant power. We talk about that as a hegemon. And one of the things they do is they kind of structure the international system, structure international politics kind of in their image. And so we've been living in this American world. And the idea would be as China rises, and it is understandable that China is kind of tired of living in an American world, and they have a different idea of what the world should look like. And so a couple of articles really get at this. And I think it's easy to feel like it wouldn't look that dramatically different. And the way China sort of frames it makes it sound like it's not that dramatically different. But there are some elements to this that I think would be really, really significant for how international politics works. And I mean, that is China's view on human rights, China's view on sovereignty, China's view on alliances, and sort of like, you know, the old kind of Cold War divisive structure of international politics. And all of that has real implications. I think we can kind of dig into each of those and how it would look different. Yeah. Should we go through it one by one? Like, how do you want to approach this?
Let's do that. I like how you framed it, right? So within international relations scholarship, we talk about hegemonic stability theory or power transition theory. And so this is something that people in our field spend a lot of time thinking about. What happens when great powers rise and inevitably fall, right? That's one of the consistent stories throughout great powers, is that as they rise, they inevitably come down. And so that means that there is going to be change in the international system. And then at the scholarly level, right, thinking about what happens in that moment when the rising power gets in that window close to the existing power. And as you said, oftentimes it's a window of conflict, right? So there oftentimes is conflict as the rising power gets close to the hegemonic power. But to what we're talking about today is the rising power wants greater say in writing the rules of the system, right? The norms that govern the system, the practices, the institutions. And so as China rises, it wants to rewrite some of those norms. You know, the last big transition we had really was the United States replacing Great Britain, right? So you have the British Empire, and as they declined, the United States took over and became the new global power. But interestingly, those two powers were very similar in their worldviews, right? So in the literature, they talk about being satisfied, right? As Great Britain declined, they were relatively satisfied. The United States was satisfied with that system. So there were really only minor tweaks.
Britain was comfortable living in an American world, right? It wasn't that big of a deal. Yeah.
Absolutely. And so what's so unique about this moment is we have to think about that question. Is China satisfied with the system, or are they going to want to rewrite some of that system? And I think what we're seeing is that no, they have a real interest in kind of rewriting some of those norms and are actively out there trying to do so. And this piece that in Foreign Affairs, one of the lead articles in this episode by Elizabeth Economy, really kind of thinks through some of that, both in terms of how China would rewrite the system, but then also that deeper question of, is this a good thing? Should we think about, does the system need reform? So, yeah, okay. So you were saying, where should we start with that? You had four things, and I've forgotten. I was jibber-jabbering and forgot the four things.
Well, jibber-jabber is what this is all about. Yes. So, I mean, your talking sort of makes me, it made me sort of shift where we start with this in some ways, which is, I think what's important to realize is that China's been very intentional and strategic about this. So China has, you know, its eyes set on creating a world that they view as better. Certainly they view it as better because it's better for them, but they're very intentional about creating, getting other people on board with this worldview. I mean, this is what, you know, global leadership is about. And it's where, you know, as the U.S. has sort of, I don't know, over the last decade kind of stepped back from some of these global, it goes further than that. I mean, I think we could look all the way back to sort of September 11th and the war in Iraq or whatever, but the ways in which the U.S. has either stepped back or been pushed back from these leadership roles. And China's being very intentional about trying to step up into that. And they do that they've been very intentional about investing extensively in the developing world. They've been very intentional about growing their influence. So kind of framing their arguments for other people and being thoughtful about who and how to appeal to different groups. And so I think that all that to say, they've been really good at this. And I think it's happened at a time where the U.S. has been kind of clumsy in our world leadership. And so I think they're kind of, you know, as we think through some of these ideas, it's important to remember that, like this, as with any politics, this is about power, but it's about influence, right? And China's been pretty effective at growing their influence with much of the world at a time that the U.S., hasn't been for a variety of reasons. So Yeah. Did you want to say something about that?
With a lot of intentionality, right? So it's not as if China is just saying, okay, how can we mine or tweak? They have basically, you could think about it as public diplomacy. I wouldn't say it's propaganda, but they're putting out these major initiatives. Our listeners have probably heard of the Belt and Road Initiative, which is maybe their biggest one, where they're reaching out doing development projects all over the world. So if you're in Africa traveling through countries, you're likely to see Chinese investment, Chinese workers there building these major infrastructures. The article also talked about the Global Development Index, the Global Security Initiative, and then what I thought was really interesting, the Global Civilization Initiative, which is sort of thinking about how we redefine humanity, what it means to interact with each other. So again, these are major initiatives. These are not just happenstance. China is saying it's time to rethink how the world works, and we should infuse much more Chinese thought into that structure.
Which is, I think, to come back around to it, like if you just look at this from a distance and you look at it in sort of an unbiased way, right? If you're not looking at it through an American lens or whatever, it is perfectly reasonable for China to, as they become increasingly powerful, you know, this sizable, world economy, a huge population. It is reasonable for them to want to have more sway, more input into the world system. I think what we see is that, and I think this is what it comes down to, is this sort of difference in values. Like, I think China is, I don't want to argue that the U.S. is not self-interested. I think the U.S. is obviously self-interested, but China is self-interested as well. So they're pushing back against some of these norms. They're really kind of pushing back against a world system that has been problematic for them. So let's talk about human rights. Human rights is sort of a good example to kind of get at. So you know, in the post-world World War II world, there has been a lot of effort from the international community, particularly under American leadership, to build this idea of global human rights, that there are certain rights that everyone is entitled to, regardless of what country they live in. The growth of that human rights, it stems from World War II and the Holocaust. And so the old idea in international relations was that countries were sovereign, and so they could do whatever they wanted in their borders without outside interference. And the Holocaust reveals the limits of that, in that, you know, if you really want to hold to that, then Germany can do whatever it wants, including these terrible atrocities. Yep. And so the international community basically said, look, there are some things that you can't do, some things that countries can't do, even in the name of sovereignty. And over the past, 75 years, we have built on those and expanded those. We've written, the international community has come up with all sorts of treaties. The UN is pushing forward human rights. And then along comes China, and China has a different view of human rights. I mean, this has to do with, the fact that they're an authoritarian state. There's just all sorts of reasons why they have an issue with this. But China is essentially calling for a return to this old notion of sovereignty, which is that states really get to decide. And in fact, it's very explicit that human rights are a state-centered concept, that countries get to decide what human rights mean within their own borders, and that's contextual. And so it is about a new vision, but it is equally about kind of pushing back against this, all the kind of progress that we've made in general. It is kind of China wanting to sort of loose itself from the tethers of these kind of modern human rights expectations. And so it's hard to sell when you put it that way, right? It is a little easier to sell to other countries around the world when you're saying to that country, like, the U.S. can't tell you what to do anymore, right? You don't have to live by these sort of international standards. You get to decide what's right for you. And that becomes more appealing. It is a win for China. They can get some people on board with it. But this is back to the, is it good or bad? I think this is one that is pretty clearly bad, right? I mean, this is one where when you push back against all this progress we've made on human rights, that is clearly moving in the wrong direction. Yes. We have a lot of history to indicate why this sort of absolutist view of sovereignty is less than ideal. What's your take on all of that?
So I agree with you on all of that, right? And the way in which this new vision for the international system would undermine a lot of the normative progress we made. But I will play devil advocate for a second here. China would make the argument that sovereignty, we have to respect sovereignty at all costs, right? Because and all the problems we've seen in the world, whether it's Afghanistan or Iraq, terrorism, all of those things are because we don't respect sovereignty. And they would make the argument that the number one goal shouldn't be these ambiguous and difficult conceptions of human rights, it should be development, economic development. That should drive everything. Pulling people out of poverty will solve these problems. It will take care of terrorism and human rights because everybody will be better off and we don't need to do this. So it's just a really interesting argument that instead of thinking about imposing our cultural interpretations of morality, we should just focus on sovereignty and economic development. And what I would say to that is, I think there's real dangers, as you highlighted, but there's certainly an audience for that. And, you know, there's an audience in the developing world that isn't as engaged in the moral conversations of the West. And there's a huge audience in the non-democracies of the world, right, who just want to develop. So, you know, the United States, we think about that everybody is as excited about the norms that we put out there as we are. But the reality is that there's a huge audience that says we're relatively indifferent to this and we want to develop our economy. So I think there is a bit of an audience for that message.
I think you're right. And I think that's really interesting because, you know, there's lots of, in political science, lots of writing and research and whatever about the kind of, you know, post-industrial society. Like there is evidence that all, you know, concerns about human rights and the environment and all of these other things are things that come along basically once you have, of, you know, access to healthcare and clean water and enough food to eat, right? And so if you're struggling to make ends meet, then these large, you know, our discussions about human rights feel, I don't know, abstract or they seem lofty, but it's not what you're concerned with on your day-to-day, you know, life. And so I think there's real truth to that. I mean, I think the reality is, and this is, you know, this is something that we can kind of talk to, the article touches on this a little bit. The reality is, and this is where if the US is open to, you know, China's role, it could be positive. There's truth to both, right? Like the ideal scenario is one in which, yes, we advance development, but we also do it with human rights in mind. That may just seem, you know, naive, but there is some truth to what China is saying. Like development is central. And we know that development leads to all of these other good things, right? That economic growth does in fact, you know, contribute to political stability and to, you know, greater life outcomes and whatnot. So, it reminds me a little bit of during the Cold War where there was much of the world that was willing to listen, was on board with the Soviet Union because they were living a very different experience than, you know, the Marxist arguments about exploitation and whatnot made a lot of sense if you were living in a former colony. And so I think there's, you know, a lot of the world that looks, you know, much of the world looks at international politics and says, you know, why does the US get to dictate everything? And there's appeal to that.
Well, and I think the other building off of that, the other thing is that there's need for reform. And I think this maybe is an interesting conversation as well. Yeah. When you look at the institutions, as you first mentioned, you know, we're talking about the global institutions that emerged after World War II, the United Nations, the World Bank, the World Trade Organization. You know, there was a proliferation of these institutions and norms, all based on sort of Western United States principles. They're not solving global problems the way that they should. The world has been transformed. We have trans-sovereign problems. You know, think about technology, AI. All of these issues are no longer problems that work real well in the system that has been created. So there's a need for institutional reform. And what's interesting is China saying, hey, we will lead that. And as you noted earlier, the United States is saying, like, these systems are great. Yeah. NATO is perfect. NATO can solve so many problems. And the rest of the world looks and goes, no. These are not adequate institutions and we need reform. And I think that's really interesting to think about. Okay, there is a need. China is stepping forward, even though much of the world would, I think, prefer the United States to lead that charge. China is saying, like, if the United States isn't going to do it and it's going to continue to operate in a kind of a Cold War institutional framework, we will bridge that conversation and start thinking about what the new institutions should look like. I find that all that really fascinating.
Yeah, I think this is the kind of takeaway of that Foreign Affairs article, which I I found myself thinking about a lot. I think it's really fascinating is, you're right. And you and I were talking before we came on, there's something about this that's very fitting with the political moment we're in. We see this playing out in domestic politics where people are frustrated with the status quo or aren't seeing the sort of gains that they were promised from globalization. And so we see this in democracies where you have this pushback, populist movements and whatnot, the Trump movements of the world. And you're seeing this sort of worldwide as well, the world is also saying, look, you know, we were promised that these institutions would do all of this for us. And they've done some, but there's, you know, there is room for change. And you're right. China's right. The institutions we live in with today are better than nothing, but they are also mid 20th century institutions. And, you know, when I talk to my students about it, like you can't understand the UN without understanding the context of when the UN was formed. So it's formed at the end of World War II. And because the international system, like it stood no chance of operating if it didn't give essentially unfair advantages to the Soviet Union and the United States. And so we have a UN that, you know, gives uneven power to the US and Russia and Britain and France. That's not ideal. It's not the way it should work. And it's certainly not the way it should look in 2024, 2025. Yeah. It looks like the world looked in 1945. And, you know, the other example, when the UN first formed, there were 51, I think, member countries, 55, something like that in the 50s. Now there's almost 200 because of decolonization and all of this other stuff. And so the world looks dramatically different. And the institutions haven't kept up. And so it is this idea that if the institutions are flawed and the U.S. is, like you were saying, standing behind them, China, even if you don't love China's vision, the fact that China is putting a vision out there becomes appealing. Yeah, it really is a call for the United States and its allies to put forth some new vision of how these institutions can be updated, modernized to actually make the world, take it even further down this road of making the world a better place.
Because I just think about some of the specific problems, like, you know, climate change, AI, technology, cyber, all of those things, right? Those are global problems. And there need to be institution norms, mechanisms to help solve those. And the ones we've got are pretty miserable. They're inadequate to the job. I mean, think about the Paris Climate Accord. You know, great for getting everybody together. But the premise of the Paris Climate Accord is every country gets to come up with their own contribution and then adjust it down if they are so inclined, right? That is not really going to solve the long-term problem, right? So having better mechanisms, better institutions, better ways of thinking about some of these trans-sovereign problems is really needed. And as we've noted a couple times, there's a desire for those states that have been excluded, you know, not just from the Security Council, but others, right? The article talks a lot about the non-democracies, right? They feel like their voice is ignored because the United States says there are democracies and non-democracies. And if you're an authoritarian system, you don't count as well. And right. So this is really interesting. How do you create a new normative, new institutional order that allows for solving some of these problems and is more inclusive in that way?
It's fascinating because this is the same. It's the same question, the same dilemma that we face in the United States, right? We have outdated institutions that should be updated, but there's a danger in choosing to update them in this moment where there's already, this sort of developed, antagonism or antipathy to those institutions. And so opening the Constitution up right now in a moment where we can't, you know, decide, like we can't agree amongst ourselves on whether democracy is good is bad. It's a problematic thing. And it's the same thing with these international institutions. Like it would have been ideal to reform them 25 years ago. Right. But now we're at this point where if we actually tear everything, you know, down and try to start over, then we're starting over with, again, this Chinese vision of human rights and whatnot. That's less than ideal as well. So, I think that's the other thing. China's really good at making these arguments and these appeals. I mean, the way they talk about it is, again, it's understandable. They talk about how a world of division, this sort of Cold War approach, it isn't helping anyone, right? That we all need to be on one team and, like you said, working towards development and sort of all equal players. But also with the understanding that China is sort of the most equal of those players, right? Like we're willing to be the leader amongst all these equals. And so it's again, like even the elements that have some, you know, some truth to them, it's not hard to trace them back to their true, like China is pursuing this, not out of benevolence, but because it is, you know, it is helping raise their standing and their power in the international system. So, I don't know really what the solution is, but I do think a world that sort of comes through on China's goals, back to the beginning of this question, is it good or bad? Yeah. I think is bad. It's not a good outcome for the Chinese sort of picture of how the world should operate. Going back to this harder vision of sovereignty and human rights, I don't think is something that we want.
No, I think that's right. You made a couple really good points there, but I think second one is coming back to this idea that, you know, we can think about institutional reform, but how we do that matters, right? And I love the comparison you made to the U.S. system. We've spent a lot of time on this podcast talking about how the United States needs to update its democracy. You know, the Electoral College is so outdated, the Senate, all of those things, right? You know, there are things that you could do in the U.S. democracy to make it better, and it's the same for the international system, right? You need to rethink those rules governing them. But you want to be careful, because if you implement, you know, China's system about sovereignty, that means all of these conversations about human rights go away. And over the last 50 to 70 years, we've seen some real and meaningful progress in terms of understanding and pushing for human rights. So I think that's why having a U.S. voice involved in this, not just involved, leading the conversation is so important, right? Yeah. And again, your other point was, again, such a brilliant point about that China is doing this for self-interested reasons, right? Which is what all states do. But, you know, I think that matters as well. And I think that's why the United States' role in this is so significant. And it's hard, but it's messy and it's uncomfortable. But this is what happens when you're the global hegemon. You have to do this, or somebody else will fill that space. Yeah.
I think about, like, in this conversation, I know we should move on to our second question pretty soon, but I've had conversations with my students recently about global human rights and whatnot, yeah. and the cynicism that they have, I point out to them, is justified. Like, you know, the idea that, like, we have these human rights standards, but it doesn't seem like they apply to the U.S. and how they carry out foreign policy, or, you know, nobody's actually holding Russia accountable or Israel accountable or whatever. And to go back to what you were talking about, it's this idea of, we've talked about in the past that this idea of, like, perfect is the enemy of good, right? And that if we expect perfection and we're going to throw out, if we look at the human rights order that we have today and say, look, it's not perfect, and some people sort of escape accountability and therefore we should scrap it. I think that's, you know, you have to be careful what you get. And it's a little bit like looking at democracy and saying, hey, this democracy is flawed, so we should scrap it. And it acknowledging it is flawed is right, but it's also, let's improve it rather than throwing it out. And that's why I think about this international order. Like, the U.S. is, you know, there's hypocrisy in the U.S. Human rights are not always upheld to, you know, across the international, not always. Oftentimes it's rarely upheld, but that doesn't mean we toss it and start over. It means we go back in, we dig in, and we figure out how to do it right.
Absolutely. That's a good way to finish that topic and then transition to our second question.
Okay, so let's talk about, let's shift gears a little bit here. And the other question that we wanted to toss around today, there was an article in The Atlantic this week. It may have been a while back, but essentially, as we approach the election, arguing that the possibility of another Trump presidency and what that might bring. This Atlantic article argued that now is the time for Sonia Sotomayor to retire, right? So she's only 69. She's about to turn 70. But the article basically was arguing we should be careful to not sort of make the mistakes of the past. So this is a really interesting question, right? So this is a strategic question. This is, you know, that we've, you and I haven't talked about this, so I'm kind of curious to hear what your take is on it. But is now the time for Sonia Sotomayor to retire? What do you think, Bill?
Well, you know, to be honest, I hadn't really thought about this, this question. And then we read this article, and I've been thinking about it the last couple of days. And I think there are a number of angles we can come at this from, but almost all of them, I find myself saying yes, Right. And so let's make the argument, the partisan argument. So the liberal, the Democratic argument is that this election is a coin flip, that, it's basically 50-50. Trump could win this election. Biden could win this election. If Trump does win this election and Sotomayor is still on the Supreme Court, that means that, it's at earliest 4 years later, but it could potentially be 8 years. Right. You never know how these things all play out. And it's not just the presidency at this point. It's also the Senate. So even if Joe Biden were to win the presidency, but the Democrats lose control of the Senate, it is not inconceivable to say that a Republican Senate would never seat a Democratic nominee. We saw that in the end with Merrick Garland, where the Senate for a year said, we're not going to have this conversation.
Not even gonna consider it. Yep.
Yes, and that may now be the norm, that the only time the Senate confirms a nominee is if they are of the same party. So the reality here is that you have to think about what happens if either the Republicans take control of the Senate or the presidency, how long before you could get another nominee on there. And Sotomayor, I believe, is turning 70, right? So that's an age where you don't know how long. And you think back to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was beloved but held on too long. And then when she passes, that seat then moves to the conservative justice, and it had a significant impact on the makeup of the court. So if Sotomayor, if she were to say retire or die during a Trump presidency, you could have a 7-2 conservative super majority, which means that the court has moved in an even more conservative direction. So I think liberals and Democrats should be thinking about this to say, is it time to gently nudge, encourage, cajole, to say it is time to move on and let Biden appoint somebody. I think it's a really, I find myself saying from the liberal perspective, yes. The other perspective, and then I'll shut up, is that thinking about this in terms of institutions. You know, when somebody turns 70, it's probably the right time for a Supreme Court justice to step away. And you've talked about this in the past when you engage in a comparative political analysis of different Supreme Courts around the world. Most of them have retirement ages. Yeah. And you correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of them are like 65, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Much younger than the United States. So I found myself saying, for that reason, it would make sense to start thinking about justices stepping away. So I found myself having not thought about this. And now I'm at the point where I think retirement makes a lot of sense. What's your thought on this?
I 100% agree with you. I had not thought about it. And my first thought was, well, whatever. And then as I read it and started thinking about it, I agreed with you. I mean, first of all, we should begin by acknowledging, like with the first topic, the system is broken, right? The fact that we have to have this conversation about strategically deciding when justices retire is evidence that the system is flawed. But to pick up on your second point first, like when I think about what would the system look like, how does it work in other countries? What would be a good model? And there's a lot of different versions of it. It could be mandatory retirement ages. A lot of them are fixed term lengths of, 9 years, you're on the court and then you move on and somebody else is replaced. Whatever those standards are, Sonia Sotomayor kind of fits the bill. She's about to hit 70. She's been on the court for 15 years. If you had asked me how long she had been on the court, I wouldn't have said 15 years. She's been on the court for a long time. So a fresh perspective, new blood is from an institutional standpoint, I think it makes sense. I think if every judge decided, hey, I'm stepping down at either the age of 70 or after I've been on the court for 15 years, that would make the court a better court. And so just from a court perspective, I think you're right. But yes, even if the system is broken, it is the system we have. And so with that in mind, the idea of like a justice should prematurely retire in order to make room for someone else to be strategic and somehow I don't like the feel of it, but you're right. When I think about it, and here's the article makes a, there was a couple of sentences from the article that were the thing that like convinced me. And I'll just read this, that talking about like, if Sotomayor, if you gamble that she can make it for another, maybe she'll live to 90 or whatever. Right. So she could be on the court forever. So here's the sentence. If Democrats lose the bet, the court's 6-3 conservative majority will turn into a 7-2 majority at some point within the decade. That's exactly what you were arguing. And the second part, if they win the bet, But what do they win? They win the opportunity to read dissents written by Sotomayor instead of some other liberal justice.
Yes, this is
obviously an insane trade. And I think that is exactly right. Like, what do you win? You win a few more years of Sotomayor versus, you know, if she retires now, you put somebody else in place that could be there. Or, you know, what you stand to lose is if you stick this out, you go 7-2 in a way that it's going to take, it's already going to potentially take decades for the court to sort of be balanced again. And you're going to just dig that hole even deeper. So you're right. From a court legitimacy standpoint, from a court balance standpoint, I think it makes sense. Whether or not this is the Ruth Bader Ginsburg thing as well. Like this, it's, you know, she is in this position. It is intentionally isolated, so she doesn't have the pressure to retire in the same way. I think if you're her and you're thinking of like sort of what's best for the court and the country, I think maybe this is the right decision to make.
Well, and the article does a nice job referencing Stephen Breyer. And so some of the concern about pushing a justice out is you've got the first Latina justice on there. Like, you don't want to do that, right? You don't want to be seen as bullying her out of a role that's been really, really important and historic. But then they talk about Stephen Breyer, and they totally did. Democrats totally, you know, bullied him into retiring, including, you know, they mentioned like, you know, comedy programs that were going after him and calling him names and whatnot. And then the author even says like, hey, I didn't have a problem with that. He's a big boy. These are important positions. And the position is bigger than the person. Yep. And then oftentimes we turn these individuals into heroes, which we absolutely did with Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Now, she deserved a lot of that, but that decision to stay on seriously hurt the cause that she spent her life fighting for. Yeah. Where now we're seeing a backlash against women's rights, LGBTQ rights, all of those things are being undermined because of that decision to stay on longer. And so, this question is, shouldn't there be, gentle nudging? Gentle pushing to say like, hey, let's think more about the long-term implications for liberal causes if you are no longer on the court, right? I don't know. I find that argument really compelling.
Well, yeah. And the idea that it's not a good look to be forcing the first Latina off the court or whatever is true, but it's back to this, like, what are the potential outcomes? And the potential outcomes are, we don't want to do that. And so as a result, 3 years down the road, she's being replaced by, you know, a conservative white dude, or she steps down now and Democrats have the opportunity to replace her with someone else who is also brings a diverse perspective to the court. And so, yeah, you're right. But I think getting caught up in these kind of, the kind of moral righteousness of it all is part of the problem that the Democrats have faced for a long time.
And you're absolutely right. You made a comment about this is the game and this is how the game is played and you have to be smart or you lose power. But all of this conversation just reminds me of the need for constitutional reform, judicial reform. There are so many better ways of doing this where, you know, in the past we've talked about like, okay, so each president gets to appoint two justices on a rotating basis. So it doesn't really matter. You're ultimately going to have diversity on the court. It takes some of the politicization out of it. There are so many better ways of doing this than the way the United States does. And that's why, I mean, right now you're nudging, you got to get off the court because otherwise, you know, all of these rights are going to be lost. And it's true. It's the name of the game right now, but it's so sad that we have to think about it that way.
It is all because the stakes are so high because we think like if this position opens up, it could be a 40-year position, right? And so you just got to lower those stakes and you lower those stakes by making them, you know, fixed 9-year terms by giving, you know, each president an opportunity to appoint it. Take it out of politics in general, let some sort of legal board make that decision. There's lots of ways to turn the heat down on these, which makes this sort of debate less important. Then we shouldn't have to have this debate, and fixing the system would do that. But again, like we talked about with the international system, fixing the system is harder than it sounds.
It absolutely is. But if you think about like, so we're getting to the stage of the Supreme Court right now where they're making a lot of decisions. We've got the immunity case. There's the abortion Idaho case. I mean, there's so many big cases now, and our political reality is now going to be dictated by what the court interprets because, you know, the legislature can't really act. Executive power has been curbed. So it comes down to the views of 9 individuals. And it really is. It's heavy, heavy politics.
Yep. To that extent, I mean, this is the position should be you know, it is maybe not as powerful as or as important as the presidency, but it's very high up there in terms of, you know, the future of the country. So.
Absolutely. Well, we should wrap up on that note right there. Phil, Ryan, now they're going to be so excited to go read these articles. So remind them how they can stay connected.
Yeah, at thepoliticslab.com, you go, you click on this week's episode. I've got a couple of articles, the foreign affairs article Bill and I talked about, an Atlantic article from a couple of years ago about the rise of China and how they view the world. Yeah. And then this piece, it's not a long piece about Sonia Sotomayor. It's really interesting. You can find that linked as well at thepoliticslab.com.
That's fantastic. All right, Phil, I'll see you next week.
Bye, Bill.
Bye, Phil.